This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The Bush administration's eavesdropping without warrants on overseas communications to and from the U.S. has drawn fire from some politicians, political analysts, legal scholars, and others. The administration, meanwhile, defends the surveillance as legal and necessary for national security in the wake of the September 11th attacks. Spying, of course, raises questions about national security, government secrecy, privacy, and liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Patrick Radden Keefe. He is a fellow at the Century Foundation and the author of Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. Keefe says the story of global eavesdropping is one of an epic struggle between two abstract concepts, security and privacy, that is playing out amid lightning-fast technological and social change. Listeners, I welcome your phone calls for our guest this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments for Patrick Radden Keefe. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. As I mentioned, Patrick Radden Keefe is a fellow at the Century Foundation. A graduate of Yale Law School, he has written articles for a number of publications, including the New York Review of Books and Slate. His book, Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping, is published by Random House. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Patrick, welcome back to the program.
Pleased to be with you.
We first spoke almost 1 year ago on March 16th, 2005. And I mentioned in my introduction of you this afternoon on February 27th, 2006, the Bush administration's warrantless eavesdropping on overseas communications to and from the U.S., recently revealed but ongoing for years. To begin this afternoon, maybe you would share with us your thoughts about this program of listening.
Well, it's funny. I mean, the story, it's a big story. Which started when the New York Times ran a piece a little before Christmas back in December, saying that this very widespread program was taking place without getting warrants from the secret FISA courts, which is really the biggest story having to do with eavesdropping in the last 30 years or so. But personally, I wasn't overly surprised. I don't think that this is necessarily the first instance in which intelligence agencies have sort of overstepped their bounds and maybe taken advantage of the amount of secrecy surrounding the kind of work they do to occasionally play a little fast and loose with the rules.
Hmm. Does this harken back at all to the listening in that the government did years ago in terms of listening in on conversations between folks in the anti-war movement and or the civil rights movement?
It does. I mean, it's interesting. In one respect, it does, in that it was back in the 1960s and 70s was really the last time when we confronted these issues, when it was revealed that there had been a very extensive, during the Watergate era and Vietnam era, a very extensive program for listening in, not just on people from foreign governments, but actual civilian anti-war protesters and what have you. And that was the last time we really had a big national conversation. There was a big congressional inquiry, and it was after that that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed. And that act essentially created a wall between foreign intelligence gathering and domestic law enforcement and created that secret process. Having said that, I think what's happening now is actually a much different sort of eavesdropping. Back then, it was wiretapping in the sort of old-fashioned sense, when you're actually targeting an individual and either picking up their international cables or actually tapping their phone. What's happening now is much more broad-based. It has come out in the last few months that it's actually happening with the cooperation of private telecommunications companies, and that the NSA has actually built a backdoor into some of the big switches through which a lot of our email and phone traffic are routed. So this is, in some respects, much more technologically sophisticated and also much more broad-based.
Yeah. Well, we've heard plenty of stories this winter about Internet search engines being asked for their users' search records. What are your thoughts about the intersect of private databases and public databases?
I think it's a very troubling question. I mean, I think that in some respects, a lot of the state-of-the-art of data mining and sort of profiling individuals has actually been carried out in the last 10 or 15 years by private companies. The idea that you now actually have cooperation between private companies and intelligence agencies is a little unsettling, which is not to say, not to cast the government in any sort of particularly Orwellian light. But what's troubling to me, for instance, is that you have big companies like AT&T, which it has recently been revealed, actually do cooperate with the NSA, and that this is a secret agreement that took place at the highest levels. So there were many people in the NSA who didn't realize this was happening, and many people who work at AT&T who didn't realize this was happening. It was based on an agreement, essentially, between officials at the NSA and CEOs at the telecom companies. And, you know, as somebody who pays a phone bill every month, I find that perhaps less than transparent.
Yeah. Do you think we'll have another debate like we did in the mid-1970s in terms of where we are in our discussion over security and liberty, over privacy and national security?
Well, I think a beginning of a debate has already happened. I mean, you had, to some extent, a bit of an investigation launched by Congress. How far that investigation is going to get remains to be seen. So the Judiciary Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, had Alberto Gonzalez come in and testify for a long and grueling day earlier this month, but he really didn't actually give up all that much information. So I think one thing this could actually indicate is how powerless Congress is. That back in the 70s, Congress actually was quite powerful and was able to glean a great deal of information about what exactly these agencies were up to, and then legislate, and then pass the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The interesting thing about what's happening now is I think Congress is kind of dead-ending in its efforts to find out just what exactly was going on.
Yeah. Well, the AP reports today that some Democrats are asking that the president appoint a special counsel to see if his eavesdropping program is legal. I kind of think that's a dead letter, but I don't know. What do you think? Where do you think the overall story is headed?
Yeah, I suspect that won't go anywhere. I mean, one of the interesting things that happens when a story like this comes out is that a lot of people make various gestures that probably won't go anywhere, but in a way, it's almost as though they're just sort of exercising their right to protest against it. So, for instance, you have a number of high-profile people who launched a lawsuit affiliated with the ACLU against the government, claiming that the government might have spied on them. Now, they'll never be able to prove that. I mean, the nature of this kind of very sophisticated eavesdropping is it doesn't leave any fingerprints. If you're hearing a clicking on your phone, it's actually a good sign the NSA is not listening to you, because they're good enough that if you're hearing the clicking, it's not them. So one of the interesting things is you have a lawsuit like that. That's probably not going to go anywhere. I suspect the president won't appoint a general counsel. Having said that, I mean, what Congress can do is try and legislate, and I think that there may be some effort to amend the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act or to amend the Patriot Act in ways that will at least, if it won't do away with this kind of surveillance, it will perhaps bring it within the letter of the law.
Hmm. How concerned should the average American be about all this?
Well, that depends. I mean, it's a tricky question, because I think that there are a lot of misconceptions about what exactly is going on with this sort of eavesdropping. The Bush administration is calling this a terrorist surveillance program, and they say that it doesn't have any interest in citizens like you and me. It's really interested in terrorists or people they know. I mean, the soundbite has been, if Al-Qaeda is calling you, we want to know why. At the same time, we've had quite credible reports that have come out in major newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times saying that, in fact, this is a much more broad-based surveillance program that has looked at thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people, and that the vast majority of the leads it's turned up have been false positives. I mean, there was a Washington Post story 2 weeks ago that said that of the thousands of people it's looked at, only about 10 people in the final analysis were actually in any way really affiliated with a terrorist group. So there's something kind of unusual going on here, which is that I think what they're doing is not so much listening to everyone, like listening to the conversation we're having now, as looking at who's calling who. So if you think when you send an email, you have the header information that just says to so-and-so from so-and-so at this time, and here's the subject. That's the kind of thing that they're looking at. And it's not even humans who are looking at it. It's computers that are sorting through vast flows of information like that, what they call metadata. So the information explaining where an email is going or a phone call is going. And if, in fact, it comes out that, you know, Al-Qaeda has been calling you, they're probably going to look a little more closely. What I worry about is that it's a little bit of a 6 degrees of separation thing, where it's not just that, you know, if Al-Qaeda is calling you, we want to know why. They want to know who else are you calling, who else is calling you. And if you move out by several degrees of separation, that's when you get false positives. That's when you get innocent people actually getting caught up in this kind of dragnet approach. And I think that's grounds for concern.
Yeah. One of the things we talked about when we last spoke was the volume of information that the National Security Agency's satellites pick up. Every 3 hours, you said, they pick up enough information to fill the Library of Congress. So it sounds to me like now they're getting a little bit better in terms of mining the metadata and, you know, picking points at which they're going to go further. But, you know, how at the moment, how good is the government at ferreting out the valuable stuff, the stuff that we do want to pick up on?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think ferreting out is really the name of the game at this point. We're much better at collection of intelligence than we are at actually processing it in any kind of a timely way. And, you know, I'm afraid if we're to go by these press reports in the last few weeks that they're not very good, that, you know, what's happening here is they're throwing the net very wide and not actually managing to identify terror cells in the way that these operations supposedly were designed to do, which is, I mean, is not to discredit them. It's a formidable task. I mean, the most recent figure is that the NSA worldwide every day intercepts 650 million communications. The idea that you would be able to sort through all of that and make much sense of it, much less in a very kind of time-sensitive manner, is pretty. I mean, it would be a daunting prospect. And you also have to think about things like translation. I mean, one of the issues is that, you know, traditionally intelligence agencies look for communications that are in code, and then they have to try and break the code. But many of the languages that the kinds of people we're interested in now speak. And I don't just mean Arabic, but I mean Dari and Pashto and Urdu and various dialects, are languages that we just don't have the analysts who can comprehend this stuff. And there's a kind of an alarming statistic. The FBI has a big database of communications that have been intercepted between suspected terrorists. And it's communications that haven't yet been translated. And as of a few months ago, that database was 8,000 hours of conversations. Mm. That hadn't been translated. So that gives you a sense of the difficulty. Of, you know, it's one thing to collect this stuff. It's quite another to make any sense of it.
Yeah, well, now, certainly since 2001, probably even before 2001, we've been talking about a need for more translators, more analysts. Where are we?
I think it's progressing rather slowly, I'm afraid. And part of the reason for this is that it takes many years to obtain the kind of fluency that you would need to actually be useful as an interpreter. And then I think there's another paradox built into this situation, which is that the NSA in particular is very concerned about security risks. So on the one hand, in order to become somebody who really speaks very fluent Arabic, it helps if you go and spend time in an Arab country. But if you've spent time in an Arab country, you become automatically suspicious as a job candidate for the NSA. So I actually spoke for a story I was writing about a year ago to several very talented recent college grads who had done 4 years of Arabic, and they had spent summers in Egypt and Syria and Jordan and places like that in order to kind of get up on the language and actually learn how it's spoken outside of the classroom. And when they went and approached the NSA, the NSA said, "Ooh, we see you've spent time in these countries. That's probably going to be a problem in the application process."
Hmm. Our guest this afternoon, Patrick Radden Keefe. He's a fellow at the Century Foundation and the author of Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions or comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign County on line one. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've been immersing myself in the story, and I'm rather worried about the abuses. As far as the NSA being wary of people immersed in the culture, they have good reason, and there's actually an Urbana-Champaign connection where, if you read The Puzzle Palace by James Vanforb, some early Russian scholars in the 50s that were studying Russian on this campus defected when they were over in Russia, and that's when actually the NSA was first revealed. It's a very interesting story. Bamford's got quite a few inside stories, and he has a second book on the NSA because he wrote that in the early 70s, I think. I'm looking at an article called Tia Lives On, It's in the National Journal. I don't know if you've seen that. It was published last Thursday.
By Shane Harris, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if you know him. I guess the National Journal has a relationship with PBS's Washington Week in Review, so I don't know if we're going to see him on talking about this. It's a very complicated story. You mentioned the corporate connections, and there actually is possibly a Champaign-Urbana connection because SAIC, Scientific Applications and International Computing, which if you look at the board of directors has been traditionally a very spooky corporation, and they were involved in planting stories in Iraq and all sorts of things. Well, they have a major section of the new research park on South Campus here, formerly called the Motorola campus, though I don't know how much Motorola presence there is anymore, but this SAIC has a cooperative arrangement with an advanced research and development activity. And it's a very interesting story, and the connections between Poindexter and his colleague Brian Sharkey, who were the original people that were talking about total information awareness with a logo that modeled on the pyramid on the dollar bill. It's almost surreal.
Well, this is one of the, I mean, this was definitely the, I mean, the story you're referring to was a National Journal story the other day saying that total information awareness, which was, has always been a bit of a kind of a bugaboo for people who believe that we should be understandably nervous about these kinds of overweening surveillance powers. Total information awareness, a data mining program developed by Admiral John Poindexter, which, in fact, several years ago, Congress killed nominally. I mean, it became a controversial enough program that its authorization and its funding was cut by Congress. What the National Journal has just revealed is that, in fact, when that happened, several major components of total information awareness were not killed at all. They just switched. And when they switched to the NSA. So, in fact, the code name was changed. The sort of institution that housed them was changed. The level of secrecy was ratcheted up, but the programs themselves kept going. And I think, I mean, that points to a number of interesting things. First of all, it points to what I was saying earlier about how this new program is not just about eavesdropping per se. It's about data mining. It's about looking through vast flows of information and trying to find patterns and useful intelligence, which is the kind of thing that total information awareness was doing. And the other thing, as you indicate, is that one of the really interesting aspects of this is that a lot of the technology that's being developed is being developed by private companies, like the ones you mentioned. I mean, there's been a big move, particularly in a post-9/11 context, for the Pentagon to create research and development money that they'll actually farm out to private R&D companies. And so in the case of this story in the National Journal, I think that's one way they were able to expose this, is that, in fact, it was some of the companies that do this research and do the development of the algorithms in question. They found emails essentially saying, well, total information awareness no longer has funding, but we've found another funder. So that was the smoking gun in this case.
Right. There are some earlier allegations that didn't go anywhere about this corporate dimension with the corporation, again, that has a presence locally called Amdocs, they basically run directory assistance services for various telecommunications, and consequently they're in a position for looking at exactly those kind of patterns as who's looking up whose number and pulling that out, but that hasn't gone anywhere. As far as what the congressional hearings will do, I'm looking at the fact that I believe last Wednesday, Gonzalez was saying that he was going to place significant limitations on the testimony of a former Attorney General Ashcroft and the former Deputy Attorney General James B. Comey, both who aren't in the Justice Department anymore. Yeah. The latter is the one who, while Ashcroft was in the hospital, put the kibosh on...
Put a freeze on it.
On this thing. They went to Ashcroft while he was in the hospital, and he was not in the position at that time to feel that he could override his friend who was the deputy. But the idea that they're going to put limitations on these people is very disconcerting. I guess the hearings are supposed to be tomorrow and Wednesday.
Well, in fact, I think that what's most troubling about this in some ways is that there would seem to be a fairly legitimate argument against having any kind of open testimony about the actual way in which this program is conducted, because you don't want to tip your hand. You don't want adversaries to, you know, turn on C-SPAN and figure out how to evade the NSA. And so every time Gonzalez was questioned, you know, about anything remotely pertaining to the actual nature of the program itself, he would say, "I'm sorry, I don't want to jeopardize this program by discussing sources and methods." Here you have a different kind of rationale, though. Here this secrecy rationale is kind of breaking its borders a little, and it's not that we don't want to discuss the specifics of the program. What they don't want to discuss is internal decisions within and discussions within the Justice Department about whether or not the program was legal, which to me seems a much less supportable argument for not having people come in and actually testify.
Well, Gonzalez wouldn't even answer any questions about unrelated subjects, which, you know, he wouldn't even say, well, they're classified. He just would say that I won't even answer a question on that issue. It's not at all reassuring, and I'm not sure Specter is going to have the backing or whatever he needs. And I suggest people maybe, at least our Senator Durbin is on that Judiciary Committee, so I think we should actually intervene and ask him to pursue it as at least as far as they can under the current circumstances. But I commend the people's attention that. I don't know if you have a website of your own where you blog or post these kind of things, but I'm glad some people are working on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting. One last, just one little postscript to that. This idea, interestingly, when you look at these accountability issues and the fact that people in the administration are really not, you know, Congress really isn't in a position to force them to talk about this program. When you look at the fact that some of this intelligence was actually outsourced to private companies, I think if Congress was feeling really aggressive, if Senator Durbin was feeling really aggressive, for instance, there is actually an opportunity here, because there's no reason why if the Judiciary Committee were to subpoena the CEOs of the telecommunications companies and have them come in to the Judiciary Committee and ask them questions, I can't really think of any basis on which those CEOs would not have to answer some of those questions. And in fact, if you go back to the congressional hearings back in the 1970s, it was very similar to right now. You had the three big telecommunications companies which had been cooperating with the NSA, and the congressional committees actually brought in the CEOs, and the CEOs had to testify. They couldn't claim executive privilege or any other reason for not actually explaining the program. So that might be an idea.
Yeah. Well, it was very interesting to me. You know, here at WILL, we carried the committee hearing where the lone witness was Alberto Gonzalez. And I think we were all surprised that there weren't other witnesses.
Yeah.
Any word on why it was only just one witness and not others?
Well, I think it's this issue of the administration wants to, I think the administration wants to stay on message and severely limit the degree to which Congress can learn the nitty-gritty, the details of what's going on. Interestingly, there is an NSA whistleblower, a gentleman by the name of Russell Tice, who was, until recently, worked at the NSA and had clearance to learn about the kinds of what they call special access programs, these very highly classified programs like the eavesdropping program in question. And he has expressed, he's done interviews all over the place and has said that he would like to come and talk to Congress about abuses that he was aware of. But he actually got a letter from the NSA essentially saying, you'd better not. I think in this case, it's a combination of a certain amount of intimidation on the part of the NSA and the administration, and then I think a certain amount of sort of a failure of will on the part of Congress, a failure to pursue this as aggressively as they should.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Interesting conversation. Talking about a lack of will, 6 years ago, very much the same kind of stories came out in the London papers in particular, or, for example, in the Sunday Times. There was an article saying that, disclosing that the spy agencies had even listened in on Princess Diana's conversations because she was into anti-mine work. landmine work, and also Thatcher's son, Margaret Thatcher's son, had been listened, eavesdropped on. In both cases, the excuse was that it was an international call. But this 6 years ago, the Sunday Times pointed out that had pointed out, for example, that Margaret Thatcher, to give you an idea how bad this can be, Margaret Thatcher monitored two of her cabinet colleagues, and according to a Canadian intelligence officer, she did so not particularly to find out what they were saying, but to find out more about what they were thinking. An American computer software manager called Margaret Newsham, who had been working at Menwith Hill, which I understand you talk about too, said that, quote, "I was aware that massive security violations were taking place. If these systems were for combating drugs or terrorism, that would be fine, but not for use in spying on individuals," unquote. You know, so, and then somebody in this same article 6 years ago, Wayne Madsen, who spent 20 years with the NSA, was quoted as saying, quote, "Anybody who is politically active will eventually end up on NSA's radar screen," unquote. And when you consider things like before the invasion of Iraq, as the Observer pointed out a couple years ago, you know, because of spying like this, the U.S. was able to scupper, to quote this another article, this time in the Observer, scupper a last-ditch initiative to avert the invasion.
Send in more inspectors.
Yeah. Excuse me?
Well, yeah, it was a last-ditch initiative to send in weapons inspectors again.
No. They were talking about a last-ditch initiative to avert the invasion by, having a compromise worked out, and that the U.S. stepped in and they told the people involved that they didn't want that to happen, that they wanted to go ahead with the invasion. You know, that's the kind of thing that can happen with this kind of spying. But I just thought I'd bring those things up and let you keep on talking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, a lot of things you could comment on there. Maybe one of the things that the caller mentioned that some listeners might not be, many listeners might not be familiar with, is a place called Menwith Hill.
Yeah, I mean, the Menwith Hill is a place that I went and visited while I was doing the research for my book. I mean, one of the interesting things about this eavesdropping story is that a lot of Americans aren't aware. You know, when we think about spies, I think a lot of people still think of sort of guys in trench coats, and that really hasn't been what espionage looks like for a long time. And in fact, the NSA, even though a lot of people haven't even heard of it or hadn't until this recent scandal, is the biggest spy agency in America. There are about 40,000 employees who work at their, you know, here in the United States, and then about another 20,000 who work at various bases, what they call listening stations, around the world. One of the biggest of these bases is a place called Menwith Hill, which is it's in the Yorkshire Moors in the middle of England. It's a real kind of cow country. It looks as though it hasn't changed in 1,000 years. Very green and agrarian, and really right there in the middle of nowhere is this enormous base with these huge things that they look like golf balls. And they're called radomes, and they contain satellite dishes, which are used to intercept communications. And this base, sort of quietly and unobtrusively sitting there in the English countryside, actually has 1,400 Americans who live there. And they live inside the base, they work inside the base. It's an enormous facility. And the interesting thing is that that's just one facility of dozens around the world. There's a huge architecture for doing this kind of eavesdropping. And I think that the question that raises, which I think the caller was getting at, is, okay, so you use this to go after foreign adversaries, you use this to go after terrorists, but wouldn't it be tempting if people had this kind of capability and they can operate in the kind of secrecy where Congress certainly can't come after you, wouldn't it be tempting to abuse it in some ways? And I think that there are certainly indications that these kinds of abuses have happened. Some of them, the caller referred to, I mean, one of them actually very recent that didn't get a lot of coverage was this summer when John Bolton was being confirmed by the Senate to become the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. There was a question raised about his handling of NSA intercepts. And the one thing people don't realize is that in fact it has been legal for the NSA to intercept Americans all this time. If somebody from a foreign country calls the U.S. and U.S. intelligence is listening in on that call, they can listen. They can keep listening, even if an American picks up the other end of the phone. What they have to do when they report that conversation and come up with a transcript and a report about it is remove the American's name. So say somebody in Saudi Arabia called me, and you have the person's name and then Patrick Keefe, they would remove my name. They would redact it and put U.S. person instead. And this has been policy for 30 years. Now, in the Bolton hearings, it came out that on a number of occasions, while he was at the State Department, he would get a report of a conversation between somebody in another country and somebody in Washington. And the U.S. person's name would be redacted. And Bolton would essentially call the NSA and say, yeah, you see that redacted name there? Who was that? And they would tell him. And there wouldn't be any kind of process of review. They would tell him. And shortly thereafter, very few places picked up on this. It wasn't covered a lot in the media here. But Newsweek did do a little investigation and found out that during one 18-month period between 2004 and 2005, the NSA gave out the names of 10,000 Americans in this way. And a lot of the time, they were giving them to Washington insiders like Bolton. Now, in cases like that, I think there really are grounds to worry that this kind of eavesdropping can be used for, not just national security purposes, but for a kind of political maneuvering and gamesmanship within the Beltway.
Hmm. Well, we did see the release of a name of an operative happen, and it appeared to be, could be, for political reasons, and that that case is still out there, and I don't know if you want to address that at all.
This is the Plame case you're referring to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
Valerie Plame and the vice president's office.
Yeah, I mean, that's a sort of a good example of the kinds of, I mean, again, to the extent that I have a strong stake in these kinds of debates, it tends actually not to be, between the sort of security and privacy end of things. That tends to be the aspect that people argue about. Some people really don't care if the government listens to their phone calls, provided the government's going to keep them a little safer. And other people are really bothered by that idea and don't necessarily trust the government to do it. For me, the issue is transparency, is that I think that we, our elected officials owe us some degree of transparency. And it may be that the secrecy surrounding these kinds of activities is such that they, they're not always going to be in a position to come on primetime television and tell us exactly what happened. But if they're not, that's why we have Congress. That's why we have, congressional oversight, so that you can actually have closed-door meetings of these sessions, of these various committees, like the Intelligence Committee, to find out exactly what went on and figure out whether or not it was on the up and up. I think the problem in a case like the Plame case, much like the Bolton case or this current controversy, is that the average newspaper-reading citizen just kind of has no idea. It all comes down to whether or not, just instinctively, you trust your government or not, and that's going to differ from one person to the next. I don't think we even have the basic information to make any kind of an informed decision.
Yeah. Well, no matter where you stand, the debate, the stakes are huge. So with that, let's go on and talk with another listener. Caller in Belgium, Illinois, line 4. Hi. Caller on line 4?
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes. Maybe I'm pretty ignorant here, but it seems to me that if you want to find out where a conversation is coming from or who's involved with it, you have to first record it. So in other words, you have to record all the conversations and then make your decisions on which ones you want to keep and which ones you don't, which means they're listening to everybody.
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, I think that there's an important distinction to be made here between computers and humans.
Well, that may be true, but you can
and
always
it may not be a distinction that means anything to you. I mean, again, I think a lot of this comes down to you as an individual and how you feel about it. Some people are really troubled by the idea that some anonymous computer out there might go through their email. Other people could care less.
Well, don't they go through everything, not only just your email, but all phone conversations and telegraphs and any kind of thing you can think of that's being telegraphically transmitted.
Well, certainly that is. I mean, I think there is a move in that direction. And the idea that that companies like AT&T actually provided access to the major hubs and switches through which all of this data goes, I mean, what you're talking about there is unfiltered access. You're talking about the agency having access to everything, and then they can kind of cherry-pick what they want once they've collected it all. So, yeah, I mean, I think in that respect, you're absolutely right.
And that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Next, we talk with a listener in Charleston, line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, thank you. I yesterday on good old Channel 12 saw the activity of Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Hitler's era and the plot to assassinate Hitler and all that that meant, the beginnings of which the program, in which I understood a lot of these things prior to seeing this program, but the populace after World War I in Germany were devastated. You know, the worldwide depression at that time was socially threatening everywhere. In Germany, the masses who were starving without work and the whole nine yards were leaning towards communist revolution in 1932, which was intervened upon by the Stalinists in Germany and in Russia. And the people were bending that way, then bending the other way, wanting the Kaiser back. Well, the parallel I'm trying to draw is between the world that Hitler rose to power in and the world in which George Bush vaulted into the world affairs. Mr. Bush, you know, it was Deutschland, Deutschland for Hitler. And for Bush, it has been 9-1-1, and all this conversation today is pointing in that direction. You know, I saved us. You know, I'm saving us from further 9-1-1s. And I think possibly that this sham that is being eaten by the masses in the U.S. is only the strides toward the sort of Hitlerite fascism that has risen since the fall of the old Soviet Union, and the oft-stated phrase, with the world's only superpower. Could you comment on that?
Well, that's that's a lot to comment on. I mean, there is one sense in which I guess I both agree and disagree with you, which has to do with the I feel as though, I mean, I'm no fan of George W. Bush. Having said that, I feel as though what is happening in the country, and I think particularly in this issue of communications and privacy, there are big changes underfoot. But I think it's happening largely with the complicity of the average American. I think that there is a kind of a trade-off that many people seem more than willing to make in this, again, in this particular area having to do with communications security, where for a little bit of convenience on the internet or at Walmart or in other areas of our life, we're willing to give up a little bit of information about ourselves, to give up a little bit of our privacy. That's an exchange that seems legit to many Americans. And similarly, I think that this idea that, you know, if it might make us safer, we're willing to make any number of sacrifices, is one that has become, it's had almost a narcotic effect on the American people in the last 3 or 4 years. I think it's a very dangerous idea, and I think that what you were getting at, and I wholeheartedly agree, is that the notion of national security essentially becomes kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card for the president, that you can whip it out any time you're in hot water. And some people, cynically, but perhaps realistically, have argued that in recent years, the fact that any time the administration seems in trouble, we suddenly get news of some kind of an impending attack is actually a calculated political manipulation of sort of popular sentiment. But I guess what I, you know, as somebody who writes and thinks and talks about these issues a lot, the problem that I keep coming back to is that I think a lot of Americans don't care. Privacy is just not that essential a part of their lives, and they're, you know, they don't seem unhappy to part with it.
Hmm. Well, I want to talk about, before we run out of time, I think in the book Chatter that you talked about improvements that are being made in terms of mining the metadata. And I think the way you referred to it in the book is we're getting better at braiding the data. And yesterday in our local newspaper, the News Gazette, an article by Greg Klein, he wrote about researchers in a number of fields coming together and working on what one researcher likes to call knowledge discovery in databases. And this is an improvement in data mining that, let me paraphrase here, would allow an improved, quote, harvest of patterns from vast repositories of digital materials. And here, as we wind up this afternoon, I mentioned in my introduction at the top of the program your quote from Chatter that the story of global eavesdropping is one of an epic struggle between security and privacy that's playing out amid lightning-fast technological and social change. What do you think are the pros and cons of the progress that we're seeing? Or you can, I'll use that term kind of parenthetically or with parentheses around, not parentheses, quote marks around it. In terms of, you know, braiding the data, mining the data, on the one hand, maybe we could rid ourselves of false positives. On the other hand, you know, you kind of wonder where we're headed.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, I think part of the problem is that 9/11 is for many people the story of great human failure. We had rivalrous intelligence agencies that didn't communicate well and human analysts who failed to connect the dots. And I think that there's been a kind of a misplaced faith in the years since in the promise of technology. I think in many respects this is a very American idea that if we just come up with the right gizmo or the right algorithm next time around, it'll tell us and we'll avert disaster. I mean, I confess that I, in this area, I'm a little bit of a Luddite. That I think, you know, absolutely we should be trying to improve algorithms. And if you can do anything, you know, when you're sorting through all that data, if you can do anything to reduce false positives, if you can do anything to protect individual privacy while also looking for various suspicious activities, then so much the better. But I think it would be a grave mistake on the part of the people who think about our national security and actually make these allocations to take the human analyst too much out of the equation. I think that you cannot just look for, you know, do a search for Muslim men driving red trucks, or as a former CIA case officer said to me the other day, two different jihadist groups, one in Virginia and one in Australia, trained on paintball courses. So what if you just went out there and searched for people who play paintball? I think you can't just do that. You need much more context. You need human analysts who understand the languages and the cultures and the people involved.
Yeah. And also it seems we need some safeguards in terms of who is holding the information and who will get the information and what will be used for.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Because on the other hand, I also want to mention that you can find Greg Klein's article online at the News Gazette. But on the positive side, there's all kinds of things that researchers in humanities and sciences could gain from a better a way of being able to braid the data, no matter what the fields that you're in. So pros and cons.
Yeah.
Yeah. There, we're going to have to leave it. We're out of time. I can give you maybe a minute here to sum up. Anything else you'd like to say before we have to call it a day?
Well, I mean, I guess that my, it's funny, the kind of concluding cry in my book, which I would sort of reiterate here, is that we need to be debating these issues. And I think that if there's one very promising thing we've seen in the last few months, it's that this issue of eavesdropping and spying and civil liberties is actually getting a lot of play on the nightly news and on the op-ed pages. And I think that, you know, Americans differ from one person to the next very strongly about how they feel about these things, but that's a reason why we need to kind of fully engage the democratic processes and the civil society we have and talk this out and think about where we want that line between security and privacy to be.
Mm. Patrick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Patrick Radden-Keefe has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a fellow at the Century Foundation and the author of Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World of Global Eavesdropping. The book is published by Random House.